last three speakers on this program were interviewed during the massive World Conference on Lung Cancer in Denver in September. And to begin, I asked Dr. John Heymach to summarize a major presentation he was giving there entitled, "Is Tumor Angiogenesis Still a Viable Target?" To begin, he commented on his answer to that question.
I think if you were to step back, you'd say on one hand, you've got several drugs that prolong survival that are angiogenesis inhibitors. You've got bevacizumab in the first-line setting. You've got ramucirumab in the second-line setting in combination with docetaxel. For lung adenocarcinoma, you've got nintedanib, which is now approved in Europe, but is not approved in the United States, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And you've had a lot of other drugs that have prolonged PFS, but haven't prolonged overall survival. So you could say, well, you know, you've got a number of drugs that have helped, but it certainly is the case that the benefits have been small and much more modest and limited than people had expected. It really seems that when you block angiogenesis, once you stop, tumors are able to snap back. And this has raised the question of, should you keep the angiogenesis inhibitors going? There's good data in colorectal cancer that continuing the angiogenesis inhibitor provides benefit. Or should you not use it at all if the benefits are pretty modest? So there's two different ways of seeing that. I think in lung cancer, it's really time now for the field to move on and decide, how are they really going to use angiogenesis inhibitors as part of a more comprehensive regimen? So for example, should we use angiogenesis inhibitors with immunotherapy? Well, there's a really good rationale for that. It turns out things that drive angiogenesis, like VEGF, also suppress the immune system. So there's at least preclinical data saying if you block angiogenesis and stimulate the immune system, you get better effects than either one alone. So I think that's a very promising combination. We know there are certain mutations that are much more responsive to VEGF inhibitors. For example, EGFR mutant tumors look like they get a lot more benefit from VEGF inhibitors. This was a study done in Japan of erlotinib plus or minus bevacizumab, and the EGFR mutant group got a huge benefit from bevacizumab. There's other groups that probably get very little benefit from adding angiogenesis inhibitors. So I think the directions the field has to go is figuring out how to combine it more effectively and figuring out how to get it into the subgroup of patients that are going to get more benefit. Now, we're going to find out if it has any role in the adjuvant setting. I think if that study's negative, the ECOG 1505 study, it'll be really hard to justify any other studies of angiogenesis inhibitors as adjuvant therapy. There was a smaller study of pazopanib that was not a positive study. And the attempts to combine it with radiation, SWOG had started a study of bevacizumab with chemo radiation, and there were some real toxicities that were problematic, tracheoesophageal fistulas. So we'll find out if it has a role in early stage as adjuvant. It doesn't look like it's got a role right now with chemo radiation in stage 3 disease. And that really leaves it in stage 4 disease in lung adenocarcinomas right now, or non-squamous. And there, to build on it, I think it has to figure out how to combine better, either with other angiogenesis inhibitors like Tie-2 or angiopoietin inhibitors, or with immunotherapy. That's what I see as the directions going forward.
So a couple of practical follow-up questions to that. You mentioned the erlotinib-bev combination. I remember when that first was presented, I ran into you in ASCO, and you were all excited and telling me about all the biology and everything. Yeah. How has this affected your practice?
Yeah, well, it's, I think, a really striking finding that hasn't necessarily gained widespread attention. You know, when erlotinib and bevacizumab was tested without respect to mutations, this was the beta study, there was a benefit for PFS, but not overall survival. This was a study by Roy Herbst and colleagues. But when you looked at the EGFR subgroup, they got a huge amount of benefit from adding bevacizumab, and that was repeated in an even more convincing
fashion.
In
that study?
In the beta study, there was a subgroup.
They looked at that?
Yeah, they had an EGFR mutant subgroup there. And the numbers were modest, but there it did look like it got much more benefit. Now there was a study exclusively in EGFR mutant lung cancer. This is a study by Sato and colleagues in Japan. It was presented by Kato at ASCO, I believe, 2 years ago. And there, the EGFR mutant group got a huge benefit from adding bevacizumab. So what I try to do for my EGFR mutants is find some way to get them the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib. Now, if they're getting chemotherapy, I will often use bevacizumab and erlotinib in the maintenance setting then. So, for example, if you got 4 cycles of pemetrexed and platinum, these tumors are very responsive to chemotherapy with bevacizumab. And then you can give maintenance bevacizumab and erlotinib, especially if you started them on chemo before you had the EGFR result. Or sometimes in patients that progress on an EGFR inhibitor, you know, then I'll look, is it feasible to combine bevacizumab and erlotinib, particularly after chemotherapy? And I have some patients who progress after erlotinib but end up having prolonged stable disease or a response with bevacizumab and erlotinib, particularly after chemotherapy. So I always do try to take advantage of the heightened sensitivity of EGFR mutant patients to the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib one way or the other.
What about ramucirumab? It was approved not that long ago, getting mixed responses from people. It seems to be obviously well-tolerated like Bev, but the benefit was pretty modest. I guess the big downside is just the cost. How do you see that trade-off playing out in the second-line setting? Both, squamous is getting a little more complicated, so I don't know if it's getting bumped to third-line.
Yeah.
At non-squamous.
Yeah, I think this was a real benefit that the drug provided. It was in combination with docetaxel, but it covered both squamous and non-squamous histology. So unlike bevacizumab that we just are using in the non-squamous histology, the benefit, it isn't enormous. It's not like the benefit that an EGFR mutant patient gets from an EGFR inhibitor, but it's a real benefit with very little additional toxicity. So if you're going to give docetaxel, I think there's very little reason not to add ramucirumab unless they had some serious cardiovascular risk factor or a recent thromboembolic event or bleeding risk. So I like the regimen. It's an option for squamous if you're giving docetaxel. And sooner or later, most squamous metastatic patients will get docetaxel. Even, you know, now it'll often be after immunotherapy, but they will still get docetaxel. So I think adding ramucirumab is a very reasonable choice for them.
Is there any issue giving it third or fourth line?
No, I mean, it's indicated in combination with docetaxel, and I think practically...
But not just second line?
No, it's just in combination with docetaxel for platinum refractory patients, is my understanding of the label. And I think practically speaking right now, for squamous histology, we would usually give nivolumab
right.
as second line therapy, but I would usually give docetaxel as third line therapy, and I would give it with ramucirumab.
What is typically your first line therapy in non-squamous nowadays?
Yeah, so for non-squamous, I'm usually using pemetrexed, platinum, and bevacizumab. Sometimes carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab.
And then docetaxel second line?
Yeah, if I'm using pemetrexed-based platinum doublet in the first line setting, then in the second line setting, if they don't have a mutation, then docetaxel, typically in the second line setting. The question is, do we start using nivolumab? Well, it hasn't reached the FDA label yet for the second line setting, but it is on the NCCN recommendation and ASCO recommendations as well, and one expects it will eventually be added to the FDA label as well. So that's really the decision for us is do we use PD-1 therapy in the second or third line setting, or do we go right to docetaxel with or without ramucirumab?
We know from our surveys that what you just described, carbo, PEM, and BEV, and PEM-BEV maintenance is very common, maybe the most common approach. But there are people who use the ECOG 4599 carbo paclitaxel bev with bev maintenance. What's the appropriate second line therapy there?
Yeah, I would use pemetrexed then. So, you know, the study that compared the ECOG 4599 regimen, the carbo paclitaxel bev followed by bev versus the so-called Patel regimen, carbo or cis pemetrexed and bev followed by pem bev maintenance. There was no difference in overall survival, even though PFS favored the pemetrexed arm. So one rationale is if you go with the ECOG 4599 with the carbo paclitaxel bev followed by bev, you haven't used up pemetrexed, and then you can use it in the second line setting.
So does ramucirumab have a role in a patient like that?
Well, the label and the phase 3 study wasn't in combination with pemetrexed. You imagine it would have a similar effect, but that just isn't what the study revealed. So you can imagine if you started with ECOG 4599 regimen, with carbo, paclitaxel, bev, followed by bev, you could use pemetrexed in the next line setting, and then docetaxel and ramucirumab would be another potential option in the third line setting, even without considering immunotherapy.
So another question about bev. We saw some data on BEV and mesothelioma at ASCO. Can you talk about what was presented there, what you think it means?
Yeah, well, the data is now looking more favorable for bevacizumab and mesothelioma. So this was a European study, and it comes on following an earlier study. There was a phase 3 study with pemetrexed, platinum, and BEV that was a negative study originally in the United States, but now this European study has a much more favorable result. So I think we're waiting to see whether bevacizumab gets added to the label for mesothelioma. Right now, typically we're using pemetrexed and cisplatin or carboplatin for mesothelioma, but we'll wait and see. The mesothelioma studies take a while to be done, and this was a pretty large, well-conducted study, so we're hopeful that it may increase our options for mesothelioma.
So one other sort of post-ASCO question I have, and then let's get on to your cases. We were talking about pemetrexed in a couple different ways. There was also the PROCLAIM study presented, phase 3 study, in locally advanced disease chemoradiation therapy with cis radiation and either PEM or etoposide. What did that show and what do you think it means?
Yeah, well, to date, there's really been two common regimens that we use with chemo and radiation. So one is carbo and paclitaxel. And the way we usually give that is weekly carboplatin paclitaxel with radiation. And then typically after you complete chemo radiation, we would give two cycles of consolidation with carboplatin paclitaxel afterwards, once every 3 weeks at sort of full doses. The other regimen is etoposide and cisplatin with radiation. Some call this the SWOG 9504 regimen. This is where you give cis etoposide with a little different schedule with radiation. And then often we give docetaxel consolidation afterwards. So those are really the two most common choices. And those are the two things we usually add new drugs on top of. So now this study was actually looking at pemetrexed and platinum with chemoradiation. And the bottom line from this looks like a very intriguing regimen. It looks like it was well tolerated, I think arguably better tolerated than the more conventional regimens with the etoposide and platinum with the better hematologic profile. So this is one that we really now, I think, have to start taking into account. And it'll be interesting to see whether this starts getting usage much more widely. Part of what's appealing about this regimen is that it may be better tolerated and easier to work in for combining with other regimens as well. Etoposide and platinum is a pretty tough regimen to give. It's pretty myelosuppressive. And so this is one where we may have an easier regimen to give with pemetrexed and platinum. It's got a little easier chemotherapy regimen as well. Now,
this combining it with what? Like in trials?
Yeah, so in other words, if we were going to start combining things like, you know, adding immunotherapy or if you were going to start other agents. To date, there's nothing we combine with chemotherapy and radiation. We recently had what was called the RTOG-0617 study where they tested either low or high dose radiation with or without cetuximab, and that was stone cold negative. There was no benefit from adding cetuximab whatsoever. And interestingly, low dose radiation looked better than high dose. So we don't have any targeted agents incorporated into chemoradiation right now. Having a better tolerated regimen like pemetrexed and cisplatinum for stage 3 disease may make it easier to combine additional things on top of it.
Have you used the regimen yourself?
Yeah, I've never used this particular combination. I've used all the others, but we're just seeing the data now from the PROCLAIM study, so it looks very good. Even though there's not a difference in overall survival, I think the tolerability is better, and I certainly would consider it.
The other thing I guess is notice they use consolidation after the radiation. I guess they gave 4 doses of PEM.
Yeah, that's right. And that makes for an easier consolidation. So when we give carboplatin paclitaxel, you know, a lot of times patients finish up this tough regimen and then they still have 2 cycles of platinum doublet afterwards, which can really beat them up. So I think pemetrexed single agent consolidation would be better tolerated.
So you say it's better tolerated and you know, you see that play out in metastatic disease pretty straightforward. But it wasn't that clear to me, at least in looking at the data and seeing the presentation. You know, I could see there was less neutropenia, but in terms of other tolerance issues, it was kind of hard to tease out. Do you think is it more than just less, you know, myelosuppression? Is it better quality of life? You know, people get through it better the way you do in metastatic disease or not really?
Yeah, I don't know the quality of life data in detail, and I haven't seen that presented. And that's complicated by the fact that a lot of the major toxicities from chemoradiation are driven by the radiation.
Right.
So a lot of the toxicities are the radiation-induced esophagitis, the pneumonitis, and so forth. If you looked at grade 3-4 toxicities as a whole, and predominantly in hematologic toxicities, it did favor the pemetrexed and cisplatin. But again, no difference in overall survival. It was dead equal. So whether those other parameters are different, we'll have to wait and see.
Let's talk about some of the cases you brought here today, beginning with your 79-year-old retired nuclear engineer.
Right. So this is a really fascinating case, and the gentleman himself is so dynamic and interesting that for me, it really beautifully illustrates the type of benefit you can get from immunotherapy. So the patient is a 79-year-old retired nuclear engineer, and he's a non-smoker, and he had squamous cell carcinoma. So first of all, that's a bit rare to have a squamous cell carcinoma from a non-smoker. I mean, he may have smoked just a little bit when he was very young, but essentially a never smoker. And he presented with metastatic squamous cell cancer. He had two lesions on the left, two in the right. Not very bulky disease. He didn't have extra thoracic disease at the time he presented. And one interesting thing about him, when I was going through asking him about his exposures, you know, and you ask smoking exposure, essentially no. And then I said, well, have you been exposed to anything else I should know about? Well, it turns out he worked assembling nuclear weapons as part of our naval nuclear program, you know, all these naval missiles that get sent off from the submarines and so forth. And he was a supervisor engineer for putting this together for the first plutonium bombs. For uranium, he was exposed to. He was exposed to tritium. And then he went on a list of things that I hadn't even heard of. So I had the part of my note where I said exposures, and I said, you know, check. Yes.
What about tissue predictors of response to checkpoint inhibitors?
It looks like tumors with a higher mutation burden have more PD-L1 and have better response to immunotherapy. As a recent work published in Science from Nair Rizvi and colleagues said that mutation burden looks like it may correlate with response to PD-L1 inhibitors, but it's by no means perfect. And actually, we have some very good examples where that doesn't happen. One of them is small cell lung cancer. So small cell lung cancer has a great degree of genetic instability. It's got a very high mutation rate, but it doesn't have very high PD-L1 levels as far as we can see. And so far, the early data says it's not that responsive to PD-L1 inhibitors by itself.
Although you do see responses, right?
There are some responses, and it looks like combination CTLA-4 and PD-L1 inhibition may be more effective. But it makes the point that this isn't going to be simple, and tumors have different ways of suppressing the immune system. So some of them will use checkpoint factors, and those will be the ones probably that will get the most benefit from things like PD-L1 inhibitors or PD-1 inhibitors. But there's other tumors that have other mechanisms to hide from the immune system, suppressing antigen presentation and other things with the microenvironment, and those will probably need other approaches.
Just kind of wondering, you spend much time talking to Jim Allison?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could imagine I'd like to listen in on that conversation.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of the real privileges at MD Anderson that we've got Jim Allison to work closely with us there. And for those who aren't familiar, Jim Allison was the one who really made the breakthrough discovery about checkpoint factors, in that case, the discovery of CTLA-4, and showing that an antibody targeting CTLA-4, which became ipilimumab, could stimulate the immune system and fight tumors. And that, since that time, has been extended now to PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors, and now a host of other immunotherapy agents. So Jim is still extremely active, and he is leading an MD Anderson effort to try to identify the biomarkers for who's going to respond to immunotherapy and discover new factors. So he's been involved in things like OX40 as a target, and a number of other ones he studied, LAG-3 and so forth.
Are these like co-regulatory factors? I've heard that term.
Right. So some of them actually are stimulatory for T cells. Other ones are just plain old checkpoint inhibitors where they put the brakes on. And Jim Mallison's group did some of the early work suggesting that CTLA-4 and PD-1 inhibition in combination may be effective, which certainly looks like that's being borne out. But an incredibly dynamic guy, so he was hiking and exercising all the time, and he noticed he had just had a little decrement in his wind, that he was getting winded a little bit more easily. And instead of thinking that this might be because he was 79 years old, he actually really felt there was something happening, and he was absolutely right, and that's how his lung cancer was diagnosed. And so we started him off on standard therapy with carboplatin paclitaxel, and despite being an incredibly vigorous guy, he really got beaten up by this regimen, and his will to get out and hike and, you know, exercise was really diminished. And, you know, he said he almost didn't feel like living if it was going to be like this all the time. And he had initially at least a minor response to chemo, but it started progressing again after a while. And his disease was still just within his chest, so he didn't have any extra thoracic spread.
Was he an educated patient? He was bringing in tons of information, seems like it.
I can tell you, as a nuclear engineer... He came in and he found us wanting for the amount of data we were collecting and capturing on him. So, for example, when I told him his tumors were getting a little bigger or smaller, you know, he wanted to know exactly how much, and I gave him the linear dimensions. I said, well, this one went from 4 down to 3. And he goes, well, that is meaningless. And he went and got the CT scans and he calculated his tumor volumes. And he spent time explaining to me that this was under the assumption they were spherical, and he knows they're not spherical. So he spent some time working on better ways to calculate his tumor volumes. And he won't even listen to the data that we give him. He wants to do all his own volumetric measurements of everything before he believes anything. So yeah, he was, I'd call him an informed consumer. And so this was back in 2013 where his tumors were progressing. And at that point, he asked what were the odds that he would live for an additional 5 years. And I told him what I would tell anybody in his situation who was 79 years old with metastatic squamous cell cancer. As I said, well, we never know in your particular case, but if you took the numbers, it would say it would be something on the order of 2% of people in your situation would still be going strong at 5 years from now.
And is that really the case?
And yeah, and that's roughly the case.
Really?
Now
that seems high.
Yeah, well, and that was a couple years ago. Now that percentage is actually growing.
Oh yeah, now is a different story.
Yeah, and this was before the introduction of immunotherapy, obviously. So when I told him that 2%, he seemed a bit downtrodden and sad, and that was unusual for him because he was so optimistic. And I said, well, don't let it get you down. He goes, oh no, I'm just feeling bad for the other 98% because I know I'm one of the 2%. And on one hand, I laughed and thought, well, I think, you know, most people think that they're going to be in that 2%. But I said, on the other hand, boy, there's nothing average about this guy, so maybe he will be. So I talked with him about the treatment options. And at that point, one option would be chemotherapy, and docetaxel was one option, and gemcitabine would be another. Now, you know, he loved hiking, but the neuropathy was really driving him crazy. He lost his sense of balance. And for hiking, this really affects you when you're getting around. He says his feet were, you know, sort of painful at night. They would really drive him crazy. And he really was not interested in a taxane that was going to cause more neuropathy. Didn't seem particularly enthused about gemcitabine when he wanted to know exactly what the response rate was in the second line setting. And when I told him less than 10%, he didn't like that. And then when he found the numbers, it was much less than 10%. So you can imagine very little enthusiasm. So then I told him we were actually opening up a clinical study. And this was the KEYNOTE-001 study at the time. And this is a giant phase one with pembrolizumab, or MK-3475, as we knew it at the time. So we got him started on this agent. And he was incredibly excited to hear about the mechanism of this and read about it and learn about it. He became a huge fan of Jim Allison, actually, when he learned about the discovery of this whole class of drugs, and said one of his dreams was to get to meet Jim Allison as well.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, so I can tell you that he started therapy, and from the onset, he noticed right around day 10 or so, he had a bit of a rash on his arms, but otherwise had nothing really significant, and then responded pretty well to topical corticosteroids. Now, I say around day 10 because we got detailed logs telling us exactly what
right.
day it occurred, what percentage of his arms was covered. It's one of the few cases where on the study we were reducing the information that we were getting from him instead of asking him for additional information. But wouldn't you know it, at the first scan he had some minor shrinkage. By the second, greater shrinkage, and after a few months, he had hit official partial response. So this was in 2013, and he's now coming up on 2 years on treatment this
wow.
October.
Hmm.
In fact, he's so excited about this, he's gotten out and he's given interviews, and he's really tried to get the word out and increase awareness about this. So he's been covered in a couple of newspaper articles and so forth. And as part of one of the newspaper articles that he was being interviewed for, they actually set up a meeting with Jim Allison.
Wow.
That was really very emotional, I can tell you. So there's actually pictures of that in the newspaper. So very tearful, and it was really a touching moment.
Wow, it must have been interesting for yeah. Dr. Allison. I don't know how often he actually sees this play out like that.
Well, I can tell you how often. He actually said it was the 10th time he's had a meeting with patients.
Wow.
And, you know, after this very emotional meeting, and Dr. Allison's a dear colleague of ours, and we appreciate him very much. So there's great pictures out there of the patient giving Jim Allison a big hug. And so I thought that was a nice story. And he is still doing just absolutely wonderfully on the treatment.
But he still has visible tumor.
You know, he does. It's actually getting smaller and smaller, as he shows us in his graphs after every scan. So it continues to shrink at this point. And one of the questions we have right now, and one of the questions he's actually asked is, how much of what's left behind is actually tumor cells versus just inflammatory infiltrate. You know, so we and others have had cases where we do a biopsy after somebody's gotten immunotherapy and the tumor may not be much smaller, but it's filled with immune cells with very little cancer left behind. So at this point, he still does have visible lesions where his tumors are. I can't tell you, though, how much of that is tumor and how much is immune infiltrate, you know, and we're not going to look until something starts to grow.
What about the issue of discontinuing checkpoint inhibitors? There are people who have the treatment discontinued because of toxicity. Some of them stay in remission.
Yeah.
Are there trials looking at stopping therapy?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point because in this study, it would have you stop after 2 years of treatment. And as you can imagine, this patient is not very enthusiastic as he's tolerating this therapy so wonderfully. He's not very enthusiastic about stopping the drug. I think the answer is we just don't know. You can imagine the scenario where if your immune system is doing its job here, you could stop the treatment. And then if it started to grow, you could reinstitute the treatment and have a response. These are going to be the details that are going to take us a while to work out, but we just don't really have any idea right now the right way to do it. Now, I will say in the case of ipilimumab and other CTLA-4 inhibitors, there we're really giving it for a much shorter period of time. And the toxicity when you're combining CTLA-4 inhibitors with PD-1 agents like nivolumab is significantly more. So there it becomes much more of an issue to sort out when can you stop and should you reboost the system with the combination.
So how about this 39-year-old never-smoking engineer? You seem to get a lot of erudite patients.
Well, this is one who actually traveled to see us and eventually moved to Houston. And so just a wonderful gentleman with a new infant and recently married, an active golfer, and just a great guy. And he initially presented with metastatic lung adenocarcinoma. This was back in 2008 with an exon 19 deletion. And I think he really illustrates, as we go through his history, the course that these patients can run and the hope there is about how different life is now for people with EGFR mutations as compared to a decade ago.
Compared to 2 years ago, too.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So he was initially treated with erlotinib, and he was on erlotinib for about 2 years. He had rash, but he was able to tolerate it well. His wife is very fastidious in terms of monitoring the toxicities and helping manage them. But he was able to go back to golfing. He had been too short of breath during that time. And in early 2010, he began to have progressive disease. He was initially treated with pemetrexed and erlotinib.
So you kept the erlotinib going?
Yeah, so the erlotinib, we kept going at that point. There's data suggesting now that maybe it doesn't help to continue it, but at that point, we certainly prefer not to discontinue it. And he did pretty well on that for a little while, but he began to progress about 4 months later. And when he progressed this time, we did a biopsy. And that was really when we just started to become more aware of the T790M secondary mutation for resistance to EGFR inhibitors. And so he did have a T790M secondary mutation. Now, at this point, we did not have a great study to put him on. And so we actually encouraged him to go to another site where he actually went on the clinical study of afatinib plus cetuximab.
I think that combination actually was the first time I remember seeing people respond with T790 mutations.
That's exactly right. So he was one of the responders, actually, in this study. You know, so he was one of the really great responders, you know, happily with this. Now, just to remind everybody, the afatinib, unlike erlotinib, does have some activity against that T790M secondary mutation. But the data suggests that by itself, it's not enough to really be active in this setting. Now, preclinically, this work originally from William Pao's group, it looked like the combination of the antibody cetuximab with afatinib looked like it was more active. And it probably has to do with the cetuximab downregulates the receptor, so it does part of the job, and the afatinib does enough to sort of finish the job. So some people were having really good responses with T790M secondary mutations, and he was one of those. So he actually stayed on this treatment from the time he started on that combination all the way until 2013, actually. So really a durable, wonderful response. Now, this was not an easy regimen. He had really bad acne. He had persistent diarrhea with this. But they learned how to manage it, and they dealt with it pretty reasonably.
How about his skin?
Yeah, his skin, this combination was tough on the skin. It was appreciably tougher than erlotinib was as a single agent. And it sort of went in cycles whenever you got the cetuximab dose as well. So he really had to be an expert and had a regular regimen of creams and other things. And with his wife's help, they got on top of any infections that happened. He would get some paronychia as well in terms of his infections around his fingernails. issues with his hair were not as much of a factor for him, but his skin did get beaten up by this regimen. And it never really leveled off the way we see with erlotinib by itself. So really, he continued even after years to have significant skin toxicity with it, but he managed to tolerate it. So he eventually progressed both systemically and in his CNS, which is where we see a lot of people who progress on the EGFR inhibitors. And so we gave him pemetrexed, platinum, carboplatin in that case, and bevacizumab. And we also interjected pulse-dose erlotinib. Now, there's data out there suggesting that pulse-dose erlotinib in people with CNS disease can induce responses. In this case, he did respond in his CNS, and I can't tell you whether it was due to the chemotherapy or it was due to the pulse-dose erlotinib, but he did initially have a response.
I mean, did he have leptomeningeal disease?
No,
that's kind of where I've heard about pulse-erlotinib.
Yeah, he had...
This for just brain mets?
Yeah, he had a number of metastases. He had gotten radiation initially to his brain, and then he had additional progression.
So he just had really bad brain mets.
Right, so that's where we added in
desperate.
The pulse-dose. Yeah, we didn't have established LMD, but we did have a number of brain mets. And he tried radiation first. So when he progressed with a whole lot of little lesions, we then went to the pulse-dose erlotinib with the chemotherapy. He had a nice response to chemotherapy, but unfortunately ended up progressing finally on that in 2014. So at that point, we were faced with additional choices. Now, his wife in particular was very savvy and was on all the message boards and knew exactly what was coming in terms of studies. And we had a study with AZD9291 there available. And we actually started him on that. And he had significant bulk in terms of disease in his mediastinum, liver mets. He had the brain mets that were under relatively good control at that point. But I'll tell you, he's just had a really spectacular response. And he gets continued shrinkage even to this time. So he's still on treatment with it. He is tolerating it absolutely beautifully, where he says it's a piece of cake compared to the cetuximab and afatinib. And he's one that could really speak to it because he's really seen the first generation drugs. He's seen afatinib and cetuximab, and now he's seen this combination. But he's had an absolutely great response, and he continues with it. He's tolerating it beautifully. And so we just hope that this continues for a long time.
Any skin issues at all?
No, he really, his skin has some durable changes that happened after the last regimen, but absolutely nothing new. In terms of his skin, really barely any appreciable toxicities. He occasionally has a little bit of diarrhea. He's on some other medications, and we're not sure what that's from, but really is tolerating it just beautifully.
So you said he had an infant when this all started?
That's right.
And how old is that child now?
Yeah, so I believe the infant, I think now at 3 or 4 years old at least, the infant was born after he had started treatment because that was one of their concerns about fertility early on with the treatments. So he was able to conceive and have a child.
So he conceived on treatment?
During treatment, and now the child is 3 or 4 years old, I believe. I can't tell you exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's his only child?
Yep.
Wow,
but
what a story.
But they're doing wonderfully. So you think now that he's gotten to see his child grow, and really very rewarding to see that.
How would you manage him if he had disease progression?
Yeah, that's a great question. He happens to have another autoimmune condition that would make him not a candidate for immunotherapy, unfortunately.
What's that?
He has multiple sclerosis,
Wow. Actually,
on top of all this. So if he didn't have that, the answer would be immunotherapy. But for him, we're just not going to be able to give him immunotherapy.
He has active MS?
Yeah, it's under relatively good control right now.
Is it being treated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is being managed. And it preceded his diagnosis of lung cancer. And it's been relatively stable. Interestingly, chemotherapy is a pretty good immunosuppressant, so it actually seems like it eased the control of his MS when he had chemotherapy.
Wow. I mean, do you consider it an absolute contraindication? Now that I think about it, I hear about Crohn's disease, and I've never even thought about the issue of MS. Do we know anything about it?
I haven't heard about it. Yeah.
Would you for sure not use it if you had no other options?
Yeah, boy, it's a great question. I guess we will cross that bridge when we get there if we really had no other options. But right now, the studies have all been done excluding patients with active autoimmune disease, so we just don't have enough experience.
So the agent this man received, AZD9291, now has a name, osimertinib, and there's another third-generation agent, rosalitinib. What do we know about them at this point?
Well, what I can say is both drugs, and there were recent publications in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed their activity specifically in patients with T790M positive disease. And they're both highly active in the patients that are already EGFR TKI refractory, response rates in the neighborhood of 60% in the T790M positives and response rates in the 20 to 30% in the EGFR T790M negative population. So activity in both, but one would expect that the FDA label, if they get approved in the near future, would be for the T790M positives first. I mean, I think there will eventually be a role in the T790M negative subgroup also. So they're both very well tolerated. They're both very active drugs. Now, there's been some recent preclinical and some clinical data about resistance to them, and I suspect there would be resistance to both of them by similar mechanisms, but the reports have been only for CL1686, I believe, and it involves a new mutation that lung cancer doctors probably are going to be hearing about in the near future, and this is the C797 mutation. So right now, we're all familiar with the T790M, and that prevents the binding of first-generation drugs into the pocket. Third-generation drugs are different because they form a link with the C797. It's a cysteine residue that's not far from the T790 residue. And when that gets mutated, the third-generation drugs, the CL1686 and presumably the AZD9291, aren't able to bind. So that's a way that we'll likely have resistance to third-generation inhibitors. Interestingly, this same residue or the corresponding residue was seen in the BTK kinase with the ibrutinib resistance for patients with CLL. So we see that the corresponding location gets mutated in other diseases also for similar drugs.
That's interesting because, you know, people with resistance to ibrutinib apparently don't do well at all.
Right. So
is that the case with this in lung cancer?
Yeah, well, presumably we're going to need a new generation of drugs that's able to inhibit not only T790M positive disease, but also presumably C797 mutated disease as well.
So one final question, and it relates back to the fact that this man had this prolonged course even before he got to AZD9291. Yep. I mean, you're going 5 years at that point. And I'm just curious, because we have seen data now looking at the different EGFR mutations in terms of response to therapy. To me, it kind of looks like exon 19, they respond better.
Yeah.
There was that one study with afatinib where there was even greater survival. But that's usually looked at things in the short run.
Yeah.
When you see people going on, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years like this, do you tend to see that more often with exon 19?
Yeah, so the data says the exon 19s do fare better. They tend to have more durable responses and they have a higher likelihood of responding. One of the other things I expect is going to be important, and we'll see more data emerge from this, is it also matters not only which EGFR mutation you have, but what else is mutated at the same time. So, for example, there's data from Rafael Rosell's group, I believe, that if you have EGFR and a P53 mutation, you can imagine that it'd be associated with greater genomic instability because P53 is really sort of the gatekeeper of the genome.
I thought these are driver mutations and you only have one.
Right. Well, so you typically have one driver mutation, but there are tumor suppressors like P53 that can be mutated at the same time. And we see a bunch of other genes that are mutated in concert with EGFR. So it may matter. The company you keep may be important. It may not matter just which EGFR mutation you have, but what other additional mutations you have. So as a lung cancer doctor, you're going to have to understand not only the difference between, you know, the exon 19 and L858R, but then you're going to have to understand the resistance mutations like T790M to first-generation inhibitors. And then when you start using third-generation inhibitors, now there's new resistance mechanisms to them. And it may also turn out to be important what else is mutated in addition to those things. So there's really going to have to be a lot of things you're going to have to take into account.
So it's just flashing on all the don't text and drive, you know, things. And
right.
I'm thinking, don't listen to this interview and drive at the same time. You know, it's just not safe.
That's right. Yes, it's getting more complicated.